From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour goes back to 1824. John Quincy Adams was elected president, but he was the first president to win the White House, even though he lost the popular vote. Andrew Jackson earned 38,000 more votes than Adams, and in fact, Jackson also won more electoral votes, 99 to 84. But at the time, the winner needed 131 electoral votes, the majority, to win the presidency. So the matter was settled in the House of Representatives, which chose John Quincy Adams. In 1876, Rutherford B. Hayes won the White House by the margin of one electoral vote, even though he lost the popular vote by more than a quarter million ballots to Samuel Tilden. In 1888, Benjamin Harrison won 233 electoral votes to Grover Cleveland's 168, winning the presidency despite losing the popular vote by 90,000 votes. It wasn't until 112 years later that another president was elected without winning the popular vote. That election included George W. Bush, Al Gore, and you don't need me to tell you that story. Well, today there's a movement to abolish the Electoral College. This week, the full New York State legislature passed a measure essentially supporting the abolition of the Electoral College. That's not going to happen until states representing a majority of the electoral votes decide to support the effort. We will update you on where that stands coming up, and we do want to hear from you. Do you support abolishing the Electoral College? Weigh in at 263-WXXI, 263-9994. But before we go there, we want to get an update from Albany and our Capital Bureau correspondent Karen DeWitt on where things stand with the budget. Lots of meetings and lots of planning to try to get things done. And Karen, this is always the time of year when they start saying, we want the budget on time, but we want a good budget. What are they saying now?
That's right. Well, they're saying now that they are moving toward a framework for a deal. In Albany speak, that means they're getting very, very close. All morning, legislative leaders were closeted in Governor Cuomo's office in a closed-door meeting. They emerged to say they're going to meet again soon, and they would not give us any details, essentially saying nothing is closed till everything is closed. All deals sort of hinge on each other in this sort of big, gigantic agreement. The legislative leaders are going to meet with their party conferences. The Assembly Democrats, in fact, are already meeting as we speak. The Senate Republicans aren't going in until 4 p.m., which means that things are going to drag out a bit. But we expect by early evening that they will have a budget deal. And if that happens, that means they can get the bills printed and go through the three-day mandatory aging period, and they can pass them on Monday, and they can have an on-time budget.
This is the time of year, as you said, for horse trading. What are the horses that they want to talk about trading?
Oh, my. Well, there's an interesting one that's developed. First of all, they're talking about universal pre-K and how much money to put into that. It sounds like there's going to be $300 million and that any school district that wants universal pre-K and can prove that they're up and ready by September will get the money. But this deal is forming, and no one knows if this is still on the table or not. It would essentially be a tax credit for the wealthy to donate to schools of their choice. This is being pushed by the Catholic Church and charter schools, and it would be tied to a version of the DREAM Act to provide state tuition aid for the children of undocumented immigrants. And so that's a possible deal that may be forming as part of the horse trading. We also have the governor's property tax freeze plan. And then there's ethics reform, including public campaign finance reform. Now, yesterday around here, we found that two lawmakers, both a Democrat and a Republican, are possibly one possibly under scrutiny by the FBI. So that may be pressing them to do some kind of ethics reform because of all the bad publicity we're getting. But, yeah, there's a lot of wheeling and dealing, unfortunately, for us reporters and the public. It's behind closed doors, so we won't really know what happens till it's all over.
Now, on the issue of the tax credit and to donate to schools, is that the way to save the DREAM Act? I'm trying to follow along as best I can here.
Well, I know. That's why it's a very strange deal. There was a cryptic kind of statement from the Cardinal of New York City, Timothy Dolan, kind of alluding to that was distributed to the press late yesterday. And it sounds like somehow if they tied those two together, maybe they're hoping they'll get the DREAM Act supporter votes. The leader of the Senate Democrats, who's in the minority, was briefly called into the meeting, and we assume they might have been asking her if she would go for that and bring some votes along for this for this deal. I guess it's a way of, you know, finding enough votes to form a coalition to get these two things passed.
We've been hearing regarding universal pre-K over the last 6 to 8 weeks. There's a debate about what it truly costs. And, of course, Rob Astorino, the Republican candidate for governor, has said that the real budgeting and the real math says that it should cost about $1.5 billion annually in this state, not $1.5 billion over 5 years, which would be about $300 million a year. And, Karen, you're saying that maybe $300 million is what they're going to put in for universal pre-K.
Yeah.
Do lawmakers expect that to be enough?
Well, yeah, probably not. It would have to be phased in over time. I think I may have misspoke. I think it was $300 million for New York City
and
for the rest of the state. But it won't be $1.5 billion this first year. I'd be surprised if we saw that. And you're right. The state education commissioner has also said it would cost $1.5 billion. So it's a pretty expensive program, and that's why you had New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio saying he wanted to put an extra tax on the wealthy to pay for it. But that's pretty much dead, that proposal. So they do have to find the money, and eventually it will cost quite a bit. And I think, as Mr. Astorino and others have pointed out, a lot of schools don't even have enough money to run kindergarten these days. So they've got to settle that problem too. And there probably will be extra money for school aid K through 12, but I assume advocates will not feel that it's enough to keep everything running the way they want it to be running.
We're talking to our Capitol Bureau correspondent, Karen DeWitt. Karen, we kind of get fixated on this deadline for the state budget. How much do politicians truly care about the deadline?
Well, Governor Cuomo is pretty fixated on it. That's one of the things that he's very proud of. After about 20 years of late budgets, the deadline, of course, is April 1st, and many years it wouldn't be done until August or sometimes the fall. He has had 3 years in a row of on-time budgets, and it's something that he wants to make part of his reelection campaign. It's something he can point to that shows that he cleared up some of the dysfunction in Albany. So he's very intent on making this deadline, and that will be interesting to see in the final deal. What concessions did he have to make in order to achieve the deadline, whereas maybe if he'd held out for a couple of weeks, he might have gotten some of these issues. But he thinks, for public perception, you know, that's something that's very clear and easy to understand. We did the budget on time,
yeah,
which in most states would not seem like a big deal, but in New York, I guess it is.
Yeah, and it has been a big deal because voters vote in May on school budgets, and the consistent refrain for years, and understandably so, was that school budgets were hard to put together when you don't know the state funding formula. So I understand that part of the complaint.
Yeah, that's right. So, they had years where they just had to guess.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll see on that. Lastly here, what do you get from the Cuomo side of this budget equation that is a deal breaker or a must-have in this budget? What is he most interested in making sure happens?
That's interesting because unlike other years, he hasn't had the kind of press conferences toward the last days of the budget saying, this has got to be in the budget, or I'm going to be mad, or I must have this. He kind of has not done that this year. So I think he'll take credit for whatever he can get. Certainly he wants this property tax freeze plan in there because he's been going all over the state promoting that. But he has not drawn any lines in the sand publicly over this budget, which shows, as I said earlier, he probably wants to get it on time and get it done and move on and, you know, do his political campaign and, you know, get reelected. That would be his, you know, happy scenario, I guess, happiest scenario of how it would work out.
For our listeners, you can hear Karen's reports all day long on our news breaks and in our different programs here on WXXI and on WXXINews.org. A very busy day and a few days coming, Karen, and we look forward to the next one. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
That's the great Karen DeWitt reporting for us from Albany on the situation there. And the other big story emerging from Albany this week, and I don't know if it is a big story yet because it doesn't necessarily go anywhere yet, but let me explain what's going on with the Electoral College. You might have seen some headlines from a couple of days ago. It's an interesting story that there are now 9 states and New York would be the 9th. There are 8 states and New York would be the 9th. To vote to decide to essentially abandon the Electoral College that has decided the way we choose presidents. As you know, the Electoral College is the mathematical decider, and there have been 4 presidents elected with the Electoral College, even though they lost the popular vote. And we ran those down at the top of the hour. If you missed that, it was 1824. John Quincy Adams was defeated in the popular vote by Andrew Jackson, but John Quincy Adams ends up in the White House. 1876, Rutherford B. Hayes was whooped in the popular vote by Samuel Tilden, but Rutherford B. Hayes had one more electoral vote. He wins the presidency. 1888, Benjamin Harrison won a lot more electoral votes than Grover Cleveland, 70 more, even though he lost the popular vote. And, of course, in 2000, with Al Gore winning the popular vote by, if my memory serves, about 500,000 votes, but losing the Electoral College after a dispute to George W. Bush. So you've got those four cases, and there is a question of whether states want to get rid of that. So the process of doing that essentially starts with state legislatures, and state legislatures, eight of them, have decided that they want to go in another direction. And most of them have been blue states, historically blue states, with an exception of Oklahoma. Oklahoma recently became the first legislature in a Republican-leaning state to back this compact. So it's going to be up to Andrew Cuomo to sign the bill that the legislature passed. But if he does that, New York's electoral votes will bring this compact up to 160, just about 60% of the target to get to that number to make a change. And earlier this morning, I had a chance to talk to Professor Jeff Cook. Jeff is the chair of political science at SUNY Geneseo. We had a chance to talk to him today about what it would mean for this country if the Electoral College is abolished. Let's listen to that conversation.
It's happened four times historically, and of course, the last time being in 2000 with George W. Bush winning over Al Gore in a heavily disputed election, and Al Gore being the popular vote winner by, I believe, half of a million votes.
Is four times, I mean, this is sort of a silly question, but is four times a lot? I mean, it sounds to me like this is not just a one-off, and we probably should have known that it's happened four times. It's happened once in recent history, but if it can happen multiple times, is it worth consideration?
Well, I think that's, opinion, I guess, is divided on that. On the one hand, the way the Founding Fathers set up the system is to make states important political units. By the creation of the Electoral College and by the creation of the Senate, and just by having states being allowed to make a number of their own laws and rules. So their intent was to make states important political units. And so they did not, I assume, saw that this was a possibility, that you could get a candidate who would win the popular vote but not win the electoral vote. And so I guess in their minds, you know, they would not see it as necessarily a problem. And again, their understanding was that, you know, what Arkansas wanted or what Alabama wanted or New York or Pennsylvania or Delaware, you know, that these entities as entities having a voice and a vote was a very important thing. And so, you know, from that perspective, I don't think it's problematic. However, I also think that from another perspective, you know, I guess I would like to think that votes matter and individual citizens matter. And as we aggregate the preferences of individual citizens, that would be something meaningful. And this kind of screwy system that we have with the Electoral College, really at the end of the day being what counts, allows for this division to occur.
And so now there's there's some momentum. There's nine states on board. It could move, with some fluidity. We could see it happen. And if it did, one of the big questions is, how would it change the way campaigns are carried out? You know, I've heard some people say, well, the candidates would just ignore large swaths of the country. But as you have pointed out, they already do that, don't they?
Right. They really concentrate all their time and all their resources on the battleground states. And so states like Missouri and Iowa, Ohio, Florida, Wisconsin, those have been the states that have been receiving the bulk of attention by the candidates. They visit those states frequently. They spend a lot of money in those states. They begin airing ads way before the general election in those states. They also, after a candidate is elected president during their first term, they're far more likely to visit those battleground states while they're president, in anticipation of those states being important when they are up for re-election. And the number of battleground states has been decreasing as the country has basically become more partisan. And so there's really just, you know, seven or eight states or something like that that are really the key states, and basically the rest of the country is solidly Democrat or solidly Republican and really not competitive.
We can debate just how much power
the Iowa caucuses have, or the early voting states, New Hampshire, and then you know, you look at the South Carolinas of the world. We can debate just how powerful they are, but you can't debate that they have more of a say, or they've got some level of imbalance in terms of the outcome in these races and the way the candidates are chosen. I wonder if the founders would be comfortable with that, and I would never ask you to speak directly for the founders, Jeff. But do you think that kind of a system? Once in a while, we hear about, well, why not rotate the states that vote first? Why always start in Iowa and then New Hampshire, et cetera? Is there some discomfort there? I don't see any movement in that part of the system. Do you?
No, I don't. I think that there's certainly a lot of people who have agree with you, and I probably would be in that camp, that you have a set of states that are unique. I mean, Iowa's relatively rural with few minorities, Midwestern state. New Hampshire is a unique state as well with very little by way of urban areas. And those states exercise more influence because they come first. New Hampshire has it in its constitution that it must be the first state, that if another state moves up its primary to be in front of it, that by New Hampshire law, it must move up its primary. And so I think there's people who would like to change it, but it just is too difficult, and it's just been too cumbersome to make any types of changes. I think it is generally advantage candidates who are more well-known, as well as candidates who are from those regions of the country. And so we've sometimes seen some candidates from Massachusetts, let's say, who've done very well in the New Hampshire primary just because they're well-known, because the Massachusetts media feeds into New Hampshire.
And finally, when I look at the idea that of what would happen if the country abolished the Electoral College in the presidential selection process, does it make sense to think that upstate New York would get more play from presidential candidates? Because obviously they would be concerned about population centers. It would no longer be about state to state. And it's not like Rochester and Buffalo are huge population centers. But at the same time, for Republican candidates, if they understand there are a lot of conservative voters upstate who sort of abandon the process knowing their state's going blue, or conversely, if Democratic candidates tend to ignore Texas because that state's going red, would that change the chance that a Rochester or smaller mid-sized mid-major cities would have in attracting these candidates?
I think they would get more attention. I think the big beneficiaries would be the urban areas, the areas where there are the most voters, and so there are those areas like New York City or Los Angeles or Chicago, all of which are pretty solidly Democrat, would get a lot more attention. However, I also think that those mid-sized cities like Rochester and Buffalo, in states that are currently not competitive, would start to get some more attention by the candidates. The candidates would visit more, would spend more money there. They might give more attention to the issues that are important to people in those areas. I don't think, again, that they would be the primary beneficiary, but I think they would be a beneficiary, and they would matter more than they currently do. I think the way it goes now, again, they candidates focus entirely on the battleground states and ignore, for the most part, the rest of the country there, and probably at least three-fourths of it. And so there probably would be some more attention, to those to upstate New York. Although at the same time, I think the urban areas where most of the voters are and where they can more efficiently spend their time and dollars in terms of trying to get more votes really would be the big beneficiaries.
That is Professor Jeff Cook of SUNY Geneseo, the chair of their political science department. If you'd like to weigh in on the Electoral College, we're going to be on this for just a few more minutes. 263-WXXI, 263-9994. We have had an avalanche of feedback on our Facebook page, and I want to read some of the comments because there are some interesting and high-charged emotions here. Paul writes, yes, 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 this is a dated system. The Electoral College does not work anymore. Same with the two-party system, by the way. And Alexis says, not only does this work, it might be worth voting if our votes weren't overruled. Kelby says it would be nice to think a national politician would then have to care about visiting a region that was otherwise taken for granted. So, we'll see. But
in a moment, I'll read some dissenting ideas. For now, I want to get a quick phone call in here. Mike is on Connections. Thanks for calling Connections, Mike.
Yeah, Evan, about the 2000 election, there is an Al Gore Presidential Museum in Florida, and it's open 4 to 5 every day because that was the vote of the Supreme Court. So the number 9 is very significant, the fact that 9 states have decided to talk about the Electoral College.
Forgive my ignorance. Is that true? Is it seriously open 4 to 5, or are you making that up?
No, it's actually open 4 to 5 every day. So, I mean, the people in Florida believe that Al Gore was the president because of the popular vote. But it's not going to change. The founding fathers created a system that by itself is balanced. And it's no matter how we complain about it, it's not going to change history.
Well, but you don't think that, again, I'm not advocating either way here, Mike. You say it's not going to change history, but it could change the system, couldn't it? You don't think that enough states will get on board?
It's like trying to change the infield fly rule in baseball. It's so ingrained in the system that it's not going to accomplish anything.
I appreciate the call, Mike. Maybe it's like trying to change the designated hitter, which we can all agree on. Well, at least that splits a lot of us anyway, and maybe we'll make a change with that. But there's a lot of people who still support the Electoral College. On our Facebook page, Joe writes, proponents of abolition of the Electoral College would have a very strong argument if they tied it to strong federal voter ID laws. This is really a do we want to live in a democracy or a democratic republic argument. A true democracy has never proven to be a viable form of government. Joe goes on to write, our founders were orders of magnitude smarter than the politicians of today. No reason to try to fix something that really isn't broken. And then he says, are proponents of abolishing the Electoral College also for the abolition of the Senate? That also flies in the face of one person, one vote. In fact, the Senate is worse than the Electoral College in many ways when it comes to imbalance. And I think Joe's point there is that if you look at Rhode Island getting 2 senators and California having 2 senators, there is a disproportionate balance of power in the Senate for the people of Rhode Island than there would be for California. The founders wrote about this in many ways, and they understood that. And as Professor Cook laid out, they did have intentions that were well understood. They knew that the popular vote winner might not always win the Electoral College. But, you know, maybe they didn't see 4 different elections going that way, and maybe they would be concerned about that. We don't want to speak for the founders, and we'll see what happens. If you're just joining us, New York State did vote this week to join the movement that would essentially abolish the Electoral College. Andrew Cuomo has to decide whether to sign it and put New York on the list. That would be the 9th state that is now on the list of abolishing the Electoral College and allowing the popular vote to choose the president. That's a story we will continue to follow here, and we're going to try to get into a little bit more depth with this and bring in some more scholars on the issue in the coming weeks on this one. We're going to take a short break and come back, and we're going to talk about a very sensitive but important subject, and that's the question of whether adults do enough to protect children from sexual abuse. And I'm not saying we don't care. The question is, do we know when there is a problem among us? That question is going to be answered next on Connections. You're listening to member-supported public radio. Welcome back to Connections. Do you know that this break is so short I can barely get guests in and out? I now have a full studio, and we're going to have a chance to talk to them in just a moment. But my colleague Helene Bianduti-Hofer is here. And
Helen, I mean, I sprint up and down the hall like a madman. The whole building looks amazing.
I know.
I got to get people. I've got like a 48
too.
Second break. This is not commercial radio.
No, it's not.
We are all content
Very
all
different.
The time.
That's right.
Helen is the host of Need to Know Rochester Thursday nights at 8 p.m. on WXXI TV. What's coming up tonight?
So tonight we've got two parents are joining me on set, and they're talking about this opt-out movement. I don't know if you've heard about this. It's a national movement. It's spreading. It's here in Rochester. And it's predominantly made up of parents who are fed up with state assessments, and they want to get rid of them for good. And their kids are actually opting out. They are refusing to take the upcoming state tests that will begin next week. And so I'm hearing from these parents why they believe this is important, why they think the district should respond, and how they think this could potentially impact the future of the Common Core standards. So we're going to discuss that.
Have you ever seen something galvanize people more than Common Core? And I don't say that because I'm not choosing a side here, and mm-hmm. I do hear supporters out there.
Absolutely, there are supporters.
But this is a real dividing line right now.
This is, and parents are, in terms of hearing from parents, I mean, they from the city to the suburbs, rural parents, they are all joining forces. I mean, this is a big deal.
What else is coming up?
So we are also looking at, there's a documentary that premiered at Sundance this year, and it's called Alive Inside. And it's all about music, well, it's actually therapeutic music, and how it can have a profound impact on people with Alzheimer's mm-hmm. and related dementia. And so I took a trip to Nazareth College. I went to the musical therapy clinic there, and I spoke with the assistant clinical professor, and we talked about how music is so powerful and how it's being used at Nazareth, how people are using it. And it's just amazing the reactions you can get. It's called Alive Inside for a reason. People come alive.
And let me just ask you here, because I wonder if someone has dementia and unfortunately, and we've talked about it in this program in the last couple of weeks, it can be a terrible march toward a loss of identity.
Absolutely.
Is the idea that a familiar song or music or in some way will sort of turn the light on for a moment
right.
and allow someone to kind of reconnect in a
Absolutely.
Way?
Absolutely. There's that connection and the agitation will dissipate, and anxiety can dissipate, mm-hmm. anger. And it creates a sense of community. They said that some of the residents, or I should say patients that are involved in these group sessions, mm-hmm. they can communicate better, and they'll actually say, where's such and such 2 to 3 weeks later, which is something that we know with a degenerative disease, that kind of thing, you just don't see it. I mean, it's amazing. And my aunt had dementia with Parkinson's, and I can remember visiting her and singing to her. And that was the thing that just, you know, her eyes would open,
and
that's when we could connect.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And then are you also good in the kitchen? What's going on here?
I am. You know, because, I am not a cook.
Well, your husband.
My husband is wonderful. Now, me, on the other hand, I've got some issues in the kitchen. And so, you know, we're in the newsroom, we are done with winter. Everyone is done with the winter.
Yeah.
We're ready for spring. And so Fina Menillo Barona, she's the owner of Fina's Cafe next door, and she said, Helen, I've got the perfect idea for you. You need to have an Italian dinner party. Let's do this Italian style. So of course I hear that, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, all the ingredients and the time that it will take. She said, nope, it's easy. You can support your local farmers markets doing this. Let's get in the kitchen and I'll show you what you can do.
Fina, by the way, I had a conversation with her yesterday. Yeah. She is an unbelievable woman.
She is.
Her personal story, I think I'm just going to pull her in here for an hour someday and just talk to her.
Oh, you absolutely should.
So
it sounds like you got deeper with her than I did. We just stuck to the food. But it sounds like you got into her story more than I ever did.
Well, I can't wait to watch tonight.
Okay.
8 o'clock tonight?
8 o'clock tonight.
Need to Know Rochester.
Thank
Helen
you.
Helen Doty Hofer, thank you. Nice to see you. Helen is going to sprint out of here now. Kick her out of the studio. I've got a full studio here, and this is such an important subject, and you might have seen a headline earlier this week, news out of the Ad Council. Todd Butler, the president and CEO of the Ad Council, is here. Hello, Todd.
Hi there.
Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Mary Whittier is here. Mary is the executive director of Bavona Child Advocacy Center. Good to see you again.
Good to see you too, Evan.
Jake Pearson's a senior account executive at Catalyst, right?
That's correct. Thank you.
Tell us about Catalyst. I'm least familiar with Catalyst, and
well,
that's no offense to you, Jake.
No, none taken. We're a direct and digital marketing agency located here in Rochester in Greece, and we got on board with this project a while back, about a year and a half ago, I guess, now.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah. So we're going to be playing a couple of the 30-second spots because I want our audience to hear it. It's powerful stuff, and I hope I'm describing it accurately when I tell you that this week when I've been seeing this campaign rolling out, the idea to me is that it's not that adults don't care. It's that either we're not noticing if a child is showing signs of abuse, or We don't know what to do if we think we're seeing. Is that? Let me start with Mary.
That is absolutely right. And okay. People are afraid. They're afraid of being wrong. They don't know what to look for. They're not as educated as they could be. And this campaign is going to help many, many, many children.
Let's listen to, we got a couple clips. Let's listen to one right away. Might as well start there, and then we'll come back out and talk about it. I pulled the audio from a television clip, but also from the radio. So we're going to listen to both. Here's the first one right now.
I think something's wrong, but I'm not sure. If I tell someone, it might get worse. I don't want to get anyone in trouble. I'm afraid.
How afraid do you think I am?
Find out what, if anything, needs to be done with one confidential call. Trust your gut, even if you're not sure. Call or go to BeBraveForKids.org.
All right, very strong there. And so, Mary, let's start with you on what Be Brave for Kids really is, and especially tackling the issue for the adults who say, I might call, but I don't want to ruin someone's life. What if nothing's happening? You know?
Right, and I think, you know, it really is that. People need to be brave. They need to take that step and make a phone call. And what we've done with the Ad Council and Catalyst is created an environment to make it less scary for adults, so that they're not calling Child Protective Services or they're not calling law enforcement. Not that they couldn't or shouldn't in certain circumstances, but what we found is people are really reticent to call the authorities when they don't have 100% proof. And what we're saying is you don't need to have 100% proof. A lot of times there's intuition, there's a gut feeling, your radar goes off, there's a red flag, you're not sure you want to talk about it. So we've created this Be Brave campaign. There is a 1-844 number, Be Brave, that people can call where they can talk to a trained professional, that person can then help guide them through the process. If it is, then sometimes it's just talking it through and there's really nothing more to do. Other times it's, oh my gosh, this needs to be attended to. So they'll call or refer me to Child Protective, maybe to law enforcement, but oftentimes even just to Bavona Child Advocacy Center, because we have people on staff all the time that deal with, as you know, child sexual abuse every single day. That is what we do.
Todd, this wouldn't happen if there weren't a need for it. And there's, to me, there's sort of parallel lines here that you've got, as Mary said, you've got this hesitance to reach out if you don't know for certain, because if you're wrong, you don't want to hurt somebody. And then there's this notion that some people think this is not happening at all, or I'm not noticing it.
We did a survey, and it's a very common first step for us when we start working on these issues, is to really understand what's going on in the community. We had suspicions and anecdotes and ideas of what was really going on, but we wanted to really understand what the perceptions and the current behaviors were in the community around this issue. And the survey showed us two main things. The first was that people believe that it exists, it happens, child sexual abuse happens, but they think it's much more common in the country as a whole and much more common in neighborhoods other than the one I live in. Yeah. Regardless of what neighborhood they live in, it's just not happening near me. So that was something that told us, you know, we really needed to get this on people's radar screen. And the second, and I think, piece of the research that was the most formative to our strategy was the fact that we asked people, how likely would you be to report abuse? If you witnessed it. More than 9 out of 10 people said, if I witness abuse, I'm going to report
and
it.
And my goodness, I would hope that it
I would hope
10.
So,
yeah,
too.
Right. Right. Okay. We're all wondering what that 10th one is.
Yeah, but, right. And then we said, well, what if you just suspected it? And that number drops all the way down to 33%. And I think it's exactly what you said, Evan. I think I've used those exact same words as I've talked about this, that everyone is afraid I might ruin someone's life with an accusation that turned out to not be true. And so what we decided, rather than taking a look at trying to, you know, boost people up over this really high barrier, because most people are only going to ever suspect. Most people are never going to witness.
Right.
So, and rather than trying to boost them up over this really high barrier, let's lower that barrier. And as Mary said, let's not say to them, the only thing that you can do is call law enforcement, which is what people think they need to do if they suspect, which, as Mary said, is not something we don't want them to do. But if they're afraid to take that step, we want to say to them, listen, there is something you can do short of calling law enforcement. And that's where 1-844-BE-BRAVE comes in.
And Mary, again, can you do that And let's say you this is entirely hypothetical, but let's say you suspect a neighbor is abusing a child. Can you make that call, and will the neighbor know that it came from you?
Absolutely not. And I think that that's another thing that's important. Whether that neighbor, if I suspect that my neighbor is sexually abusing a child, whether I call the 1-844-BE-BRAVE or I call the CPS hotline because I'm just going to do that, the Child Protective Services legally cannot disclose who made the referral and report. People can guess all day long, and they do try to do that, but certainly for the Be Brave, it is a confidential call. You don't have to give your name, your any of your information. What it really is a resource to talk through it. People want to be educated and reassured. And again, sometimes those calls will result in something taking some action being taken, and some won't. And what we say is, we understand people feel like they want to know for sure, but think about, okay, we would rather have you err on the side of caution. We'd rather have you call in and it's nothing than you don't call in and this kid continues to be molested. And we have had those situations many times at Bavona with professional mandated reporters that didn't do anything.
263-WXXI, 263-9994. With the part of the clip that we heard, Jake, that got me is, you know, the adult is saying, you know, I'm scared. And then you've got the child's voice that says, how do you think I feel? That's so strong.
Well, that was the goal. And what we were trying to do there is get people to who might be reporting, someone who might want to take that step to make a phone call, but they're not sure what to do. They're afraid that, as Mary and Todd said, that if they make an accusation that night the police show up on someone's doorstep. First of all, it's not how the process works. There has to be an investigation. But to get people to a point of picking up the phone, there's a lot of time there's rationalizations that sometimes are mentally excuses that you have. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not going to call because I'm not positive, or what happens if I'm wrong? And that's what we were trying to address at the beginning of the ad, putting someone in the position of the adult who thinks there might be something going on, thinking through what those steps might be, and then trying to create a greater motivation to pick up the phone by saying, well, what if you're right? Think of how afraid the kid is.
Yeah.
And so really trying to get people forward to that end part of the ad where they talk about the phone number, picking up the phone. It's a confidential call. You don't have to worry about being right. You don't have to be an expert. The people there are.
263-WXXI, let's get to the phones. Bernard in Fairport, you're on Connections. Thanks for calling.
I appreciate the effort of these folks to basically handle this problem, but it seems to me that one of the basic questions that I have is, why can't people call the police? Don't the police know how to handle this stuff? Are we missing the point? If something is wrong, we're supposed to call the enforcement. Now, I appreciate them helping through the process, but is the process broken? Thanks for the show.
Yeah, thanks, Bernard. Who wants to start there? Mary?
I'll take that. So thank you for your call. And you know what, Bernard, we would love everyone that suspected something that they thought a child was being hurt to call 911, because that's the most instant response, right? What we're saying, and what the research that Todd referred it to, is people don't do that because they are afraid the police are going to show up on my doorstep, take my kid away, do all sorts of things that they've got in their head that may or may not even be true. So because we know that people won't call the police unless they know for sure, what we're saying is, if you won't call law enforcement, there's another alternative and option for you to talk through the situation with trained professionals that deal with this all the time. So trust me, I would love it if every person suspected that they called law enforcement. Would I have loved the assistant coach at Penn State to walk through that shower and have called law enforcement first before his father? You better believe it.
Yeah.
But he didn't. And that was a witness case.
What a good point there. And by the way, we have a question from Joanna on Twitter. She just wants to know, what is the process of investigation if you don't go through police?
Suspected child abuse.
Someone calls, and let's back up. If you're just joining us here, this is a new campaign designed to protect children and help adults understand that that there are ways that you can make sure kids are being protected. Even if you're uncomfortable or you're worried about where it's going to lead, there are ways to do it anonymously and safely. And Todd, website and phone number for people?
1-844-BE-BRAVE. And the website is BeBraveForKids.org.
Okay, and so what Joanna's asking on Twitter is, okay, I called. How does the process unfold then?
So you call the Be Brave hotline, and you talk through your situation. The trained professional on the other end of the line, we've coordinated and collaborated with 211. This is Lifeline. So these folks get calls, everything from, where's my local food cupboard, to, I think I want to kill myself, to having to call in a regular child abuse situation. So these people are very well trained. We did additional training with them on sexual abuse specifically, because this campaign is specifically around sexual abuse. Having just said that, it's still okay to call us anyways on the Be Brave if you think it's something else, some other form of abuse and neglect. Mm-hmm. So the person calls in, they work with this trained professional, and let's say the person calling in, boy, they got great radar screen, and this is clearly a sex abuse case. This trained professional is going to talk to the person calling in and saying, this is what we really need to have you do. The best thing to do in this situation is call Child Protective Services. This is the number. I'll give it now anyways. Child Protective Hotline is 461-5690. Mm-hmm. And I'll help walk you through that, or I'll make a transfer right now. Stay on the line, Mrs. Smith, and you can do that. Or it's a situation where, and not to get into all the details of this, but some cases of child sexual abuse, believe it or not, don't go through the CPS system because it's related to how the offender and the child are connected. So if it's dad doing the molestation, it absolutely gets a CPS response. If it's an 11-year-old with a gentleman down the street, yeah, that's a law enforcement referral. So maybe it's to 911. They can also connect to 911. Let's say it's still ambiguous. They can call Bavona Child Advocacy Center. So we have a whole process for people calling Bavona Child Advocacy Center as well. So there's a number of different ways depending upon the situation. It's very case by case. And I'll tell you, the hotline has been up for what, almost 24 hours, and we've already gotten a call on a very, very serious sex abuse case.
Wow. I want to listen to the second clip if we could now. This is the radio spot that's been out for this campaign that you're going to hear, and we'll listen to this and come back and talk about it.
I am a survivor of sexual abuse. I can say that because one adult thought something was wrong and was brave enough to help.
You can help save a child from sexual abuse. If you suspect something is wrong, even if you aren't sure, make the confidential call to 1-844-BE-BRAVE. Trained specialist will help figure out what, if anything, needs to be done. Visit BeBraveForKids.org or call 1-844-BE-BRAVE.
A child will thank you, I promise.
A message from the Ad Council of Rochester and this station.
I'd like to hear Todd and Jake talk about that. You hear a child saying, I'm a survivor, and that's a very direct, strong message right off the top there, Jake.
It is, and it's a slightly different tack than we took with the TV. Same strategies going throughout it, but here with the radio, it's letting you know how directly you can impact a child's life. Is that someone survived this process in this case because someone was brave and stepped up and took those first steps. Some adult helped out and reported a suspicion. And I wanted to take a couple steps back to the why this phone number, why a separate thing than CPS. It would be great if everyone called, but there's 20% of people in some national studies that we looked at showed that 20% of the people who were aware of something who didn't report did so because they didn't know what to do. So CPS exists, the police exist, people know that those places exist, but they don't always call them when they see something coming up. So that's part of the reason that we've got this, and this radio spot really is, again, trying to increase that motivation to pick up the phone, call 844-BE-BRAVE, and talk to the trained professionals there to find out what steps might need to be taken.
One of the things, Evan, if I can just interject here, one of the things that's important about what we're trying to communicate in that radio spot is that this child is a survivor of sexual abuse. She's not a survivor of sexual abuse because she fixed the situation herself. It is up to, one of the things I've heard Mary say that I've come to repeat as often as I get the chance is that as the adults in this community, it is our job to protect children. And so that's what that child says in that radio spot. She says, I'm a survivor, and I can say that because an adult took some action. And so that's really the point that we're trying to get across with that spot. And that action is a safe action that you don't have to be afraid of as an adult.
And that's exactly right. And there's 10% of kids who are abused will disclose. Another way to put that is 90% don't. So 90% of them, yeah, do need someone to step forward for them.
And there's also a line in, I think this line is in both of the ads, television and radio. You say, make the call, and they'll help you to help determine what, if anything, needs to be done. I think that that's actually a very important clause, because that's, to me, a little bit of a wink to the audience that says, I know you think maybe I'm wrong, and we get that, but we get that. Your calling doesn't mean someone's going to jail or that you're definitely... Am I overreading it, Mary?
No, and I think that's true, and a lot of it is determining what, if anything, needs to be done. That was put in purposely, and the marketing geniuses on the other side of the table here, who are really good at what they do, can explain the rationale. But
do I pass my marketing exam?
Yeah, I was going to say,
absolutely,
Evan.
Yeah. I'm just bursting with pride for you.
But I think people need to realize that this is a resource for the community, and to Jake's point, less than 1 in 10 children will disclose that they've been sexually abused, and that is because 90% of kids are molested by someone that they know, love, and trust.
Yeah.
This is not stranger danger. This is mom, dad, boyfriend, girlfriend, soccer coach, and it's so hard for kids. We need to stop putting the responsibility of children disclosing on their shoulders. We need to educate ourselves as adults. We protect kids by putting them in car seats and with bike helmets and seat belts. Why are we not taking more action to protect them in this way?
If you're just joining us this afternoon on Connections, we're talking to Mary Whittier, the executive director of Bavona Child Advocacy Center. Jake Pearson is with Catalyst. Todd Butler with the Ed Council. And they're partnering for this new campaign that is based on some of what the Ed Council uncovered in the numbers. And the numbers found... more than 9 out of 10 of us, and hopefully close to 10 out of 10 of us, if we witness abuse, will report it. But only about a third of us if we suspect it. And that number doesn't say a third of us if we think it might be possible, probably not. I mean, that means we suspect actual abuse. We suspect it. We think that there are signs that there is something wrong. And two-thirds of us do nothing. If you don't know Mary's tough, and I wonder, Mary, if you saw those numbers from the Ed Council and you were a little angry.
Well,
or at least saddened, maybe.
Well, but not surprised, Evan. So we deal with this all the time. I cannot tell you the number of calls we get at Bavona almost every day from mandated reporters. We're talking about teachers and therapists and people in law enforcement sometimes and other disciplines where they just want to not take action. They think, well, it can't really be that. Of course not. Or they call us and say, well, I have this situation. You know, well, how long have you known about it? Well, about 2 months. Really? Like, really? So these are professional people that work with kids that allegedly have tons and tons of training. And, you know, this is not a knock on the school system. I mean, you know, our educators are fantastic, but they're also exposed to our children more than we are sometimes, even as parents, every day, 8 hours a day. A number of calls that we get that want to walk through something because I'm not really sure something's going on, when clearly it's absolute 100% reportable. So if you've got that in the professional, think about the young woman back here who is your average community citizen that doesn't deal with children. Think, you know, what's the likelihood that she's going to then tell? So it is enraging, but I try to keep my emotions under wraps. How am I doing? But I think, you know what? It's kids, guys. And you know what? If you suspected animal abuse, how many people would be calling? All 10.
That's an amazing point. It's an amazing point because animal abuse gets people furious. And child abuse should get people furious.
Please. Yes.
Now Mary is getting fired up. Now it's happening. Okay. Here it comes now. And by the way, we don't mean to malign the outstanding engineer behind the glass. Lindsay's been doing a great job.
Yeah.
We appreciate that. But let's start to wrap our conversation on an important point here. And this isn't the hour where we look at all the signs of abuse, but I do think it's worth asking you, Mary, if there's anything you'd want the audience to know about general signs that they may feel are either ambiguous or they just don't know.
Sure. So one of the things I'll say is that Bavona evaluated more than 1,500 kids last year, and we've actually evaluated almost 12,000 children in 9.5 years that we've been around. 42% of the kids that we see at Bavona are under the age of 7. And so that's...
42%?
42% of the children are under the age of 7. 35% of those kids are boys, and almost half come from the suburbs. So if you think that only happens to the poor inner city black kid, wake up, because it's happening in your neighborhood in Pittsburgh. So what I would say is when I give those numbers, there's context, because when we think about what we want to look for, every age range is a little different. Most child sexual abuse manifests itself in behaviors for kids. So it's, this was a really outgoing kid, loved going to Uncle Sam's house every Saturday, never wants to go now. Now, does that mean that Uncle Sam is doing something? No, but should it be in your differential? Yes, because now they're so fearful of going there. That children at a young age have very promiscuous behavior. I can't tell you the number of really promiscuous behavior that children exhibit, and then sometimes exhibit on other kids because of what they've been exposed to. Withdrawn, kids that are very, very good at school, that all of a sudden their grades are failing. Most of it is behavioral, not physical. And that's just how it is. Most cases of child sexual abuse, in 95% of cases that we know a child's been sexually abused, they have no physical findings.
Wow. And Todd is reminding us that those signs are where, Todd?
That you can find those on the website that Catalyst created for this campaign, BeBraveForKids.org.
Mary, as we close the hour, were you surprised at the back and forth that happened in the Woody Allen case with his daughter?
Oh.
I'm not trying to get you too fired up, but you know, that has drawn a lot of controversy because some people are standing by Woody and others are saying,
of course,
we don't have physical evidence, but we've got his daughter's now coming out
right.
And saying it.
So that's what we say, and if you talk to some of our ADAs, they say this a lot of times in court. Think about the courage and the guts and how difficult it would be for a child to accuse someone of doing this. What gain do they have? This young woman for years has sort of suffered from this. She's talked about it, but now talked about it much more openly as an adult.
Yeah.
What would she have to gain? People can say, oh, money, this, that, and the other. I'll tell you right now, the professional community, many people in the professional community, in the community that I deal with every single day, absolutely believe that she was victimized as a child by him. And, you know, didn't he marry a stepdaughter at the age of 17 or something? Am I dating myself here? But
you're right.
Some ridiculous thing. And again, people don't want to, you know, we hold these people in such high esteem. But also think about all the celebrities now that are coming out that are saying that this happened to them. Because now we are having a community-wide movement, a national movement, thanks to many folks in the media, where we can talk as openly about child sexual abuse as we can AIDS and breast cancer and HIV and juvenile diabetes and all sorts of other social ills. We need to have the same open conversation with our own children, with our colleagues, with our friends, with our families, to say, no more.
Yeah. Mary Whittier from Bavona, and we've got to wrap the hour. Jake Pearson with Catalyst, powerful stuff that you've created.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Todd, the website and the phone number, do it again.
1-844-BE-BRAVE and BeBraveForKids.org.
Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you all.
Thanks.
And Mary, it's easy to get you wound up, but you know, that's real passion, and we appreciate that.
Thank you.
And we appreciate our listeners as well here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We'll see you for Innovation Friday tomorrow.